Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, a very happy February 5th, 2013. Thanks for joining me today. I'm the founder of Responsible Eating and Living. You can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's real, R-E-A-L, and find out more about me and my nonprofit. And I'm a foodie. I think I'm a foodie. I'm pretty passionate about food. And today I've got some wonderful other foodies on the show, and I think we're going to have a really good, fun time talking about my favorite subject, food. Now, Julia Child, I need to work on that a little bit more, but that's a fun voice to imitate. Julia Child, she has influenced so many foodies in the world, in the United States, and all over. And I wanted to tell a little story about her before I introduce my first guest. You're familiar with John Robbins, my friend John Robbins. He's the son of Baskin and Robbins, Irv Robbins, who created the ice cream empire, Baskin and Robbins. And he was destined to take over the ice cream empire. And then he went on his own way and he wrote this groundbreaking bestseller in 1987 called Diet for New America. And he has influenced so many of us. And we've learned so much about our food system and how food affects not only our own health, but the health of the planet and how animals are treated. He's done tremendous work. And he was speaking at a lot of conferences when his Diet for a New America book came out, and he was at one with Julia Child. And when they had some time off, John tells this story about he asked her if she wanted to visit a veal barn that was near the conference that was taking place in Pennsylvania. And so she agreed, and she wasn't interested in vegetarians. She thought vegetarians were sentimental, and she just cared what food tasted like. But they did go to this veal farm, and John describes it where you could see calves chained at the neck. The chains were really short, and the animals couldn't move, and they couldn't lay down. And they would live about 3 to 4 months before they were slaughtered. Of course, they were fed a diet that was devoid of iron in order to keep their flesh white, because people considered white meat healthier and tastier. And they're advertised as being milk-fed, when actually they're not fed their mother's milk. They were fed skim milk and petroleum byproducts. Anyway, John brought Julia to this small veal farm, and it's nothing like the factory farms that we see today. But she looked around, and she simply said, "Can we go now?" And then she said, "I had no idea, no more veal." Now, this was at a time when she was pretty old, and you don't hear this story in her documentary or when people tell stories about it, but I think if we all knew more about how our food was produced, there's a lot of it that we would not tolerate. Certainly the cruelty and all the toxins and things that go into our foods, if we really knew and understood and made a noise about it, I think things would be a lot better. And that's one of the things that we do here. So that's just a little story about Julia Child. And now I want to bring on my first guest. And Julia Child had an influence somewhat on him. My guest is Mitchell Davis. He is the vice president of the James Beard Foundation, a cookbook author, a food journalist, and a scholar with a doctorate in food studies from New York University. A graduate of Cornell University School of Hotel Administration, Davis spent 2 years cooking and eating in France and Italy before settling in New York City to write about food. And we're going to learn a lot more about Mitchell Davis. Welcome to It's All About
Thank
Food.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. I've been looking forward to this for months since I first met you a while back.
Indeed. And full disclosure must be that Julia Child and James Beard were very, very close friends their entire adult lives. I think they were the giants, literally and figuratively, of food in America.
Right. They both brought French cuisine to the United States.
They did. Well, they did, although that was really Julia's purview. Beard brought good food. He hated the word cuisine, the word gourmet, he was famous for hating. He grew up in Portland and was a West Coast boy all his life, really, even though he made his life and career in New York City. And I think that one of the differences was he loved European food, French food, Italian food, whatever, but he was American, and I think that's come to be his hallmark, really, or his legacy.
I liked reading about James Beard, knowing that before he was a foodie per se, he was trying to make it as an actor.
Yeah, in which restaurant could we go to today and not find someone just like that?
That's everybody's story in New York City. All the servers that you get, that's their story. Sure. But James Beard actually made it in the food business. Yeah. Good for him, and made it well. And then,
and actually, he's on the stage right now. There's a play about his life, a one-man show that was written last fall. It premiered in Indianapolis at the Indianapolis Repertory Theater, and has just been remounted in Portland, Oregon, his hometown.
Awesome. Yeah. Have you seen it?
I have seen it twice. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Do you recommend it?
I do. It's a really interesting piece. The playwright is James Still, who did a tremendous amount of research, and it's Beard looking back at his life, sort of at the last few days. Well, we don't know actually if death is imminent, but he's old and reminiscing about Julia and all the sorts of things that changes that he's seen. It's interesting.
Hmm. Do you think it'll make it to Broadway?
You know, there's always hope.
Okay. Well, let's learn a little bit about you, how you got interested in food, and how Julia and James and
sure.
everybody influenced you.
I used to tell people I was weaned on Julia Child because I came to know James Beard late in life. I think the generation before me, I started cooking from a very young age. I was born in 1968, and my family just loved to watch Julia on TV. We were already a TV family. So,
can you do a good Julia imitation?
There have been a few Halloweens when I've been known to, that her and the Swedish Chef. So food has just always been an interest in my life, and I went to hotel school, as you said, and which was sort of a compromise, because at the time I wanted to be a chef from the time I was really mm-hmm. little, and it wasn't okay in some circles, you know, a middle class Jewish family. It just mm-hmm. you didn't go become a chef. I think a lot is different now. It's amazing to see, you know, when we were sitting recently, the Beard Foundation has a relationship we can talk about another time at the State Department, with the State Department of the U.S. And I just none of the chefs there could believe they would ever find themselves feted by the Department of State of America for all sorts of reasons. And so things have changed like that. But I went to hotel school, which was a wonderful place, and then went to Europe, as you said, and cooked in France and in Italy, never really expecting to cook in a restaurant because I later learned it is the hardest, one of the hardest jobs there is to have. I have so much respect for chefs. I hang
Absolutely.
Out with them. They're my friends. It's tough work. I think we forget when you see it on TV sometimes.
It's very romantic, and it's an art, and so many of us dream of it, but we don't dream of the sweat.
The sweat, the heat, the lifting heavy
the pace,
things. The pace.
The empty restaurants.
Yeah. Right,
for
the danger. I mean, it's kitchen, a commercial kitchen is full of very dangerous
yeah.
things.
Anyway. I got my food certification. I took the test for uh-huh. the city certification, and it scared me just reading about it, thinking about all the things that could go
yes.
wrong.
One of the most terrifying things I ever experienced myself was a sushi training hygiene course.
Ooh,
where you,
raw
yeah,
fish. Whoa.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah. I mean, you keep yourself safe of a lot of things by not eating meat or animals of any kind. But there,
yeah.
then there's still things that
can
happen.
I mean, I love avocado maki, all the maki rolls right. that you get in a Japanese restaurant. But when they're using the same knife and the same cutting boards,
yeah.
if
or the way or they or when the animals are being raised next door. And the chain is contaminated. I mean, there are so many things
yeah.
we could talk about. Anyway, but I did have an eye opening in Paris, as I mean, as cliche as it sounds, about food. And it wasn't so much I grew up eating really good food, but it was the food culture that really changed me. That people were, I don't think anyone in France would call themselves foodies, although now there's a trend called le foodisme, and that's a whole trendy thing in France. But it wasn't that they were foodies. It was just that food was as important a topic as art and literature and music and all the sorts of things. It was right up there, and it was okay to care in a way. And that's, I didn't know it then, but that's become one of the things that I spend my life doing, is getting people to care. I don't want to tell you what to eat. I mean, I think we should all eat wholesome, well-raised, environmentally sensitively produced food. But I also want to empower people to actually pay attention to food, and to I think it's through that attention and discernment that we move towards better practices and better food.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I lived in the south of France for 4 years, and that was one of the things that I loved about it. Everyone cared about food. I think, unfortunately, because of American influence, some of that may be changing as much as they're trying to fight it. The
sure.
younger kids are not fighting that culture.
Well, and Europe is changing. One of I've spent a lot of time in Italy since that time I lived in France, and you see the model of Europe, because of the same economies of scale and pressures or perceived pressures of production or all that sort of stuff, they're almost regressing or moving more towards what was we have in America, the system we have where everything is made in this place and shipped here, all the produce is grown in this country and shipped over there. And we're finally realizing we're at the end of that, where we're realizing actually that leads to really horrible things, and we need to go back and re-regionalize. In Europe, the sort of formation of the EU was a federalist project that, you know, strong producing countries with strong economies were making food and shipping it elsewhere. Anyway, so it's been funny. I mean, sad to see that shift, but it does feel like something's changed drastically here, where an increasingly large group of people is understanding the regionalization, the importance of re-regionalizing our food system. And that's something I have to say that James Beard, and I never knew him, but I've worked at the Beard Foundation now for 20 years, and so I know a lot about him and have spent a lot of time in his stuff, so to speak. And it was something that he always celebrated. One of his most famous books was American Cookery, which came out in 1972. It's a giant, thick book, which at the time I think was rare. Now all cookbooks seem to be these giant tomes. There's one right in front of us. But it was a celebration of the differences of American things, not all the sameness of American things. Oh. There are lots of recipes for beans, let's say, and they're different from town to town and region to region, and he has them all. He didn't just want to find the one bean dish. So there's something really resonant today, I think, with some of the groundwork that he laid in his life. He wrote from 39 till he died in 1985. He was constantly producing stuff. And I do think he had a lot of the values that have come to be embraced by the food movement before anyone realized there was something different going on.
Yeah, I really am bothered by all the sameness that goes around in the United States, and starting to see it in other countries, too. You know, on our street in Forest Hills, a Chipotle just moved in. You know, we have a lot of these small little mom-and-pop stuff, and I love it because it brings all kinds of culture and interest and variety.
Totally.
Oh,
you forget, I mean, not just in food. I know this is a food show, but, yeah. You know, in office products, you know, everyone has the same trash can, and that drives me crazy. Like, why can't there be different ones? It all has to be the $2 trash can from Staples. Like, that, I mean, it's part of the challenge, I think, because, you know, we're so obsessed with the economics of anything that economies of scale are so appealing for certain groups of people, and they lead to all of this sort of sameness. And food, I think, is the most is the realm in which the effects of that are most detrimental. I mean, obviously, it doesn't really matter what your garbage can looks like. You're putting garbage in it, although it would be nice. When you go to Europe, you see, oh, wait, there's different doorknobs. Every doorknob doesn't come from the same place.
They're all from IKEA.
Yeah, well, okay. But in food, too, food is the place where I always say food is not widgets. You actually, whether or not you believe in the business model of other industries, when they're tried to apply to food, what you get is the crap that we're all fighting against. It isn't just an aesthetic fight. It's about our health and the planet and the environment.
I was thinking when you were talking about doorknobs, it wasn't doorknobs. It was toilet flush mechanisms that were so varied in Europe.
Right. And you never so varied that you don't even know what to push or where to look.
You wouldn't know where they were.
It's from
like,
the ceiling, right.
What do I do now?
But no. we take that for granted. I mean, I have to say, it's so funny because even in America, I was born in the New York area. I was born in New Jersey, and I grew up in Toronto. And in Canada, they put light switches in different places. So my whole life, I learned where to look for a light switch. And you come here, it's usually outside the room. Mm-hmm. And here, it's always inside the room. And these are small things you take for granted. There are cultural differences. And food is the biggest area where that is true.
I want to get back to France just for a minute. Have you heard the story about the vegan who walked into Chez Bocuse?
No, but was there a rabbi and an Irishman involved or no?
No. So when I lived in France, I was living with a Frenchman, and we were first living in Lyon, the cuisine capital of France and the world. And he wanted to celebrate my birthday at the best restaurant that he knew of, and that was Paul Bocuse restaurant, Chez Bocuse. And he called them 2 weeks before my birthday to say, look, I've got this vegan with me. Now, this was the early 90s.
Okay.
And he explained what I ate, what I didn't eat. And they said, you know, sure, no problem. Aucun problème, venez, and come on in. And 2 days before we were coming in, He sent them a fax to remind them of what the situation was. We showed up at the restaurant, and no one had a clue who we were. And
so
every course was a disaster. I had to have the same conversation. It had to go back. And there was, I think there was only one other filled table. It was a weeknight. It wasn't busy. And yet I got the worst awful scowls. Now, I have to say that in the 4 years I lived there, I never had a bad experience except that one time. Most chefs were very welcoming, and they said, I accept the challenge, and I was always satisfied and got some really beautiful dishes.
Interesting. Bocuse was the first assignment I was ever given in the food world as a professional food writer. I was working at a magazine called Art Culinaire, and the first person I had to go interview was Paul Bocuse. It's a little intimidating, although I'm surprised at that level, at a Michelin three-star level, they wouldn't have found that fact somewhere or done something for you.
Couldn't do something.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I wonder how much that's changed in those years. I have a feeling it might still be not difficult. As you said, it was an easy time, but there's a cultural component to it also that we talk about a lot amongst my colleagues. And there are, in different food cultures, there are ways that diners are in restaurants. Like the relationship between the restaurant and the diner is different. And in America, of course, it's always about the customer's always right.
I wanted to bring this up, and you're bringing it up.
Funny.
So perfect.
Yeah, so the customer's always right, and the customer has needs, and the servers, quote-unquote, are there to serve those needs. And that is not how it is in a lot of places. And I think of Japan even more than France, where there are so many rules, and they're a food-obsessed culture, but often people consider them rude, but I feel like you are operating so outside what they understand behavior to be that they don't even know how to react or how to help in some cases. And although we think of the French, actually no one really thinks of them as being just like us, but it's, but there are these things that we take for granted. And I think they're very...
The ugly American.
Yeah, well, ugly, but also open in so many ways, unbound by all of these other rules and traditions. I think that's partly why our food right now is so exciting and there's so much going on here, because the rules sometimes only let you go so far.
Well, the thing about chefs and French chefs is they feel like what they're doing is an art, and they are offering their art to you, and you don't change what they're offering. But today, in a world where people have food allergies and religious issues, and then there are people, crazy vegans with ethical issues, is there a balance? I think it was around 2002, I forget when it was, but I had never met another vegetarian when I lived in France. And then in the early 2000s, they had the first Veggie Pride Parade.
Oh, hysterical.
And I love that they called it Veggie Pride,
right,
because they were literally coming out of the closet.
Right.
Because they were hiding.
Right, right. Well, I once asked a famous feminist scholar, you know, why was all this amazing work going on among French women feminists at around the same time. It seemed so funny in such a sexist place. And it was like, duh. She's like, where else would the reaction be? Where else would you need to assert veggie pride except in a place where meat prevailed? In some ways, you'd have to rally. But from that can come amazing change. I mean, as we see in other social issues.
Okay, let's talk about the James Beard Foundation.
Sure.
And how did that come about, and what did they do, and what do you do there?
Well, Beard died in 1985, and the foundation was born posthumously. He had nothing to do with it, theoretically, except that there was this home where he lived in Greenwich Village on West 12th Street. And in that home, so many people had such warm and important associations with it, because he was really this the ultimate host. He invited, in fact, Julia Child is a great story. When her book was about to come out, she came to New York. Her publishers brought her and her co-authors, and they asked her who she wanted to meet, and she said there was only one person. It was James Beard, and so he threw a big party. And the idea that he threw a big party to introduce people to each other, to celebrate food that he taught in his home, so many people had come through there. So students and colleagues and friends of his thought it was a bit of a shame that this home would not become live on, let's say. And it had been on the market for some time, and they just raised the money to buy it without really knowing what the foundation would become. And in 1986, when there was enough money to purchase the home, Peter Kump, who had a cooking school in New York and was a student and friend of Beard's, bought the home, and to just raise some money, everything had been auctioned off. It was an empty shell, except for Beard's longtime companion, Gino Cofaci, had a lifetime lease on a floor with Beard's dog, his pug, Percy, and there was another tenant on the fourth floor. So the two floors were empty. Peter organized a dinner to raise some money to buy some stuff for the house, and Barbara Kafka was very important in that. She wrote a book and gave the money to the foundation to also buy some stuff. And Wolfgang Puck was this young, hot start Californian chef, and he cooked a dinner, and I think 14 or 16 people came, and everyone thought this was great, and they started to hold dinners. It became, that's how we evolved from that idea. And it was kind of radical. It's funny now that every restaurant has a tasting menu, like vegan restaurant, any restaurant has a tasting menu. But at the time, the idea that there would be a place you'd go for dinner, there'd be a set menu, you would sort of see a chef perform, was kind of radical here. And it just grew through word of mouth. We've always been a 501c3 nonprofit, so we are a public company. For a long time, we used to fight against this idea that it was a private dining club, except that everything we always did was always open to everybody. Excuse me. Of course, everybody with the means to have dinner, which is a whole other topic we can talk about. But increasingly now we have over 200 dinners a year with different chefs every single time from somewhere in the world. So we become this performance-based. Julia Child actually called us the Carnegie Hall for Chefs. Hmm. And then in 1991, we started something that really catapulted us into the national and international stage, and that was the James Beard Awards for chefs and later books and food journalists and restaurants and radio broadcasters and all kinds of stuff. And those awards were the first sort of coveted merit-based recognition for chefs. There were other trade organizations and awards like that, but it was the first time that the consumers learned about them. I mean, it's funny because today, every time I turn on the TV, whether it's Letterman or Top Chef, they're always saying the James Beard Award-winning or James Beard nominated, but at the time it was crazy. There was nothing. That was almost 25 years ago that those awards started, and they've really grown to be the most coveted thing of what we do. A couple of other things we do and have always done alongside them. Part of our nonprofit status is we raise a lot of money for scholarships and tuition waivers for people who want to pursue a career in the culinary arts, we say. Almost $4.5 million since we started that in 1991 we've given away or awarded. And then just in the last 5 years, sort of as all the world of food has changed and chefs' interests have changed and people who consume food with a passion of foodies, let's say, has changed, we've started to get into some of the issues that everyone is waking up to about how the food is produced. And we started an annual conference called it's called the James Beard Annual Food Conference. It's very creative, but it's about sustainability and public health. And we bring thought leaders and the whole idea together. And the whole idea is to bring as many diverse perspectives and opinions into the room and to try to not so much, change, you know, it is to change what people think, but it's really to change what people believe, to change their values. I mean, we feel like it's funny. Chefs at the highest levels are working with the finest products in the truest sense, you know, small produced, locally produced. It's sort of where that movement began. And I think America's unique that way. You saw that in the south of France. Mm. No, that was just what you took for granted is that things
That's
came
right.
from around here. Mm-hmm. In America, it's come the other way, top down from the chefs on down. But not, you know, when you have the CEO of a giant global food corporation sitting next to a farmer or a chef, we hope we can make some value shifts that will move everyone a little bit farther. We don't have our own political agenda per se, although some of us keep it deep inside and hope it oozes out all over the room. But really, we want the people that we bring there to move everything more where we want it to go. So we've been doing more and more work like that. And it's been very rewarding, both because of the connections and the value sharing that we've seen, but also just to empower chefs, as I said, to really take the front line of food folks and put them in these positions to change some of these other people who are so removed from the act of producing and eating food because of the nature of business.
Well, I think that food should obviously taste good, look beautiful, but it can also be good for us. And I think all of that is very possible and should be part of the equation for anyone putting together a dish. And gentle on the environment.
Absolutely. I agree. And I'll add, just because I've come from a great couple of panels about the workers who actually produce the food, and if we're talking about ethical eating, we really want to make sure that it's that the ethics are shared for all of the people and plants and things that touch that food. I think it's really important.
You have something called the Enlightened Eaters series, and I know my friend Linda Long, she was on this show recently with her newly published Virgin Vegan. She'll be talking on March 6th at noon at the Beard House.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little more about the Enlightened? I like that.
Yeah,
I like
sure,
to think I'm an enlightened
you.
Eater.
Yeah, and I think everyone needs to aspire to be an enlightened eater. We spend so much time trying to ignore the connections of things. Enlightened Eaters, they're free conversations. They happen a couple of times a month. They're always at noon. We have they're in line with another series called Beard on Books, where other authors come in. But Enlightened Eaters, obviously, are authors and chefs and sometimes dietitians or people coming in to talk about these very issues about the wholesomeness of our food in some important ways. Linda Long is a great example. Who'll be talking about her new vegan book.
She also authored Great Chefs Cook Vegan, and I love that book, too, just because I think all restaurants should accommodate all eaters.
For sure. And it's one of the things we like to do at the Beard House, where we've had a few vegan meals, although, quite honestly, not as many as I want to be able to tell you we've had, but more than it's an increasing number, because we really want, to us, the most educational public service of the house, the Beard House, would be to allow chefs to do things in there that they couldn't normally do for whatever reason they think elsewhere. So whether it's explore an ingredient, we have this amazing tomato event every year where people, every course from soup to nuts is tomatoes. And also we once famously asked David Chang, a chef famous for his aggression in some ways towards vegetarians, to cook a 12-course vegetarian menu for us, because we want to challenge people to think about things differently. And it's nice to be able to do that when we can.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, and I'm glad that you're having this Enlightened Eater series. So if anyone's interested in it, they can go to
jamesbeard.org, and all of these things are on the calendar that we're talking
about. And the James Beard House is located at 167 West 12th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues here in Manhattan.
Excellent. You can also follow us on Twitter, is where you get the most up-to-date information. At Beard Foundation is our Twitter handle.
Right. We just have maybe a couple minutes left, and you know, you mentioned, you didn't use this word, but I'm going to use the word privilege. You know, we both have a great privilege to be able to choose our food and talk about our food. And the James Beard House promotes a lot of chefs that many of us can't even afford to go to. How does that fit into the equation?
I mean, it's a good question. And increasingly, I actually did a TEDx talk about the idea that I think we need to change the notion, and one of the things that's been limiting us, an obstacle for some big food system change, is that this perception that local food, organically raised food, all these sorts of things are only for people with means, and that I think if we could shift the mindset, the value system of the folks in charge of big food companies to think that that should be the de facto stance. That's the right, that it isn't just a luxury to choose food that's ethically raised or environmentally sensitively raised, but that ought to be the standard. And you see that in other countries around the world, that then the separation, I think the persistence of the separation, although very real because of how we set up our business model, helps to keep, I mean, for lack of a better word, rich people, giving them the options to eat better, and we just think that poor people ought to be happy for what they got. And I don't believe that at all. And I think that some of the work that we need to do is to change that everyone has a right to be discerning about their food and to have wholesome food raised well. If you set the playing field levelly, then no one can keep them apart.
Yeah, we all are entitled to clean air, clean water, wholesome, nutritious food, a roof over our heads.
Yeah.
And these should just be basic rights.
Yeah, I would add healthcare in there
because absolutely.
I come from Canada and I can't believe some of the things you hear here.
Yeah.
That, anyway.
Well, thank you, Mitch, for joining me, and it's all about food.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back for the second part of our show. I'm going to be talking with Annie and Dan Shannon. They've got a great new cookbook out called Betty Goes Vegan. We'll be right back.